Greetings, Topher Delaney here in beautiful Petaluma with David Duskin, and you are listening to Garden with Topher Delaney, a podcast focused on the earth. Here we are.
Thank you for having me.
I've known David for a number of years, and that's been a delight for many reasons. He's a very, very good artist. When did we first meet? How old were you then?
I was in grad school, so 30. We've known each other for almost 20.
Are you sure you weren't 60?
I might have been. maybe on the inside.
Yeah, on the inside, you were so knowledgeable.
I'd lived a lot already.
You had.
A lot of things had happened.
Yeah, yes. You had. You are a wizened man. And why are we here, David? Why are we in this office? Is this a director's office that we're in?
Yeah, this is the office for a nonprofit that I formed with my wife, who's a collaborator, Darlene Gonzalez, and some other friends who are founders and community members. So we formed this nonprofit called Petaluma River Park.
Let's back up. You have lived in Petaluma for how many years?
About 12, 13 years. Yeah, we moved here when we became pregnant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And you moved here from where?
We had an apartment in San Francisco, a little underneath bottom of a building, and then I had a studio out in Tomales, and so we were sort of split between the places.
And why do you live in San Francisco? Are you from San Francisco?
I grew up mostly there. Mm-hmm. I was born there, and then my parents moved around quite a bit when I was little, but then we ended up there, and so the majority of my childhood was there, sort of right on the edge of Golden Gate Park.
And are your parents in the arts, or what are your parents do?
Well, my mom grew up in Scotland, and she's done so many things. She's always been a gardener, so mm-hmm. I'm sure that's influenced me quite a bit. And then she was a lactation consultant for a long time, and then she worked in various nonprofits. But the majority of her energy went to supporting us, mm-hmm. the family, the house, the garden, my father. And my dad spent his life as an entrepreneur in environmentally related businesses, generally. So sometimes he was working on hydropower, sometimes wind power.
Oh, okay.
But then sometimes cornflakes for a little while, and he started off in the garment business.
Is your father from Scotland also?
No, he's from San Francisco. Oh. His parents were Jews in San Francisco who were in the garment business, making knit goods for Jewish women with short torsos and long arms, they said. That was their niche. So he ended up doing other stuff in fashion later, but then he really wanted to do things that would leave the world better than he found it, I think.
Do you have many brothers and sisters?
I have two sisters. So my dad was married twice. So I have three half-siblings and then two sisters that are full siblings.
And are they younger or older than you are?
I'm the middle child, so one older and one younger. I'm the middle and the only boy.
And what's the name of your mother?
Sarah.
And what's the name of your father?
Alvin Duskin.
Sarah Duskin.
Sarah Duskin. Maiden name was Urquhart. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And why were you traveling around? Because your father was in wind energy and you had moved to a windy place? Or?
He needed a job at one point, and so he went to Washington, D.C. to work for a senator or a congressman. And he wrote a bill giving people tax credits for having windmills. And then
Really? Immediately
came out west and started looking for people to get tax credits for having windmills, which were ranchers, basically.
Mm-hmm. What year was that?
This must have been early 70s. Mm-hmm. And so it was through a company that he was working with were the first ones to put windmills next to each other and have this wind farm idea.
Fantastic.
And they started off with lots of small windmills, mm-hmm. and many of them broke, and many people wanted their windmills near the highways, which wasn't where the good wind was. Anyway, the wind industry had its ups and downs, but it's nice that he was a part of starting it.
So you're growing up in San Francisco, moving around with your family, connected to your father's employment, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you go to high school here?
My mom, having grown up in Scotland and being very attached to land, always needed some land. Otherwise, it wasn't home.
What part of Scotland is she from?
Near Edinburgh, or near Aberdeen is the closest bigger town, but quite rural. And mm-hmm. she grew up in the middle of real farm and real forest. And her father planted 1,000 acres of trees by hand in his lifetime. And so she just grew up around this, and that's what felt right. So she always had to have something like that. So, for example, we were living in San Francisco. The company's rented place, but she wanted to buy a place in Sonoma that had a few acres. So she could always have her hands dirty.
Planting trees, like her father.
Planting trees, planting flowers, planting chickens, all of the things.
It sounds like you were involved with your mother's efforts, particularly your mother's efforts, to be grounded, to make transitions with planting. Is that right?
She always pulls everybody else into her projects. So, you know, this is a wonderful thing and sometimes a difficult thing, but she still does it. And so you get a lot out of it. She insisted that we be involved in all of that stuff and learn it.
So when you go to college, what do you decide to do?
I was in San Francisco and I went through high school. I started getting into the arts in high school. I was really into academics, but I found that what I really also liked to do was hands-on woodwork, metalwork, just making stuff.
So your high school had a shop?
It had a shop, full shop program. It was a college prep and a trade school mixed. So that was fantastic for me and was really the key to me buying into academics, I think, and staying there.
What school?
Lick Wilmerding High School out on Ocean Avenue.
Okay.
Which it still is, but back then it was particularly a rough neighborhood. It was exciting because it was really urban and it was rough around the edges. And you had these big shops where you could explore stuff. I had a great metal teacher that started me off, Mary Anderson, who went to NYU, and she sort of did a lot of swearing and would say, "Turn on the torch, I'm not going to teach you anything, go for it," you know. And she ended up teaching us a lot.
It is interesting, this mix of vocational and intellectual, those two paths that they're actually layered together.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to broaden a student or an individual's viewpoint. Would you agree with that?
I agree. I mean, I think, at least for me, if it's all academic, then it's all academic and it's all about talk and reading, and it's all very internal. It's great for self-growth and all of that, but I found it profoundly unsatisfying to not also do stuff as a result of that learning. I've always been into books and stories and all of that, and academics. But because I wanted to do something with it, I did my undergrad in 3 years instead of four because I was just urgent to, like, stop practicing, and I wanted to do stuff and go get a job. And
did you go to art school
in my undergrad? I went to UCSC and then I double majored
what
in
is that?
Art
and
UC Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
And then double majored art and English lit.
So you were doing the vocational academic together. It was
for me, it's very much the same thing. I couldn't make the art I wanted without understanding people better, and a way to understand people better and the world better was by reading.
Mm-hmm.
Through novels, through listening to stories.
That's such a wonderful observation. What books were you influenced by when you were in Santa Cruz? And for folks out there, Santa Cruz is part of a state system. These are University of California colleges that are public colleges and competitive to get in. But they are public versus the privates, which also means you have less tariff, frankly.
It really helps. It makes a huge difference. It was the smart option. And it was also, I was in love with the campus. I mean, that's what really made me go there, was to realize this campus was in the middle of a redwood forest. So to be able to sit in a astronomy lecture and then on the way to a theater class walk through a redwood forest was sort of the perfect transition. So for me, I knew I had to go to college because that's something you're supposed to do, and I didn't know what else to do really at the time. But the place was a place I wanted to be.
Sounds like heaven, no pun intended. So you take classes in astronomy, you're doing the literature. Going back to that question, what writers influenced you at that time in your life?
Probably at that time, I was really influenced by Joseph Campbell's work. It's a comparative mythology and religion and looking at universal human themes. So that was a lens that was interesting to me because it helped me understand my story and other people's stories as a process with beginnings and middles and ends and helpers and events. And it just sort of gave me a picture of what the arc of that story of a lifetime was.
Oh, nicely said. That's really nice.
Or could be.
So folks who are listening to this podcast, at the end of the podcast is an index that my terrific partner Calvin Chin assembles in each podcast. So no need to get a pen out and re-listen to who that author is. And so that is Joseph Campbell, and we'll list the title of the particular book that David is talking about, or a series.
Yeah. And then I would say I was really interested in religion at the time. I still am. So I was reading a lot of books about comparative religion stuff, but I particularly was drawn to the Tao Te Ching with a translation by Stephen Mitchell, because he took out the he, she stuff, which made it much more universal, just more applicable. That was a big influence. And then I remember back at the time reading Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run With the Wolves. Mm-hmm. She's a poet. So it was really a book about women and nature, but I included myself in that. Even though I identify as a man. It was just very inspiring. There was a novel part, and there was recommendations on how to live your life, and yet it was very poetic. Mm-hmm. And I'm usually interested in books that aren't stuck in one particular genre, books that can go off the rails, like Finnegan's Wake. I like those kinds of things.
That's a complicated book.
It is a complicated book, yeah. My uncle used to open it up at the dinner table and just start reading it out loud. And
is so this to be, your mother's brother?
Yes, yeah. Alex, mm-hmm. who's... great. He spent his life as a farmer also. I still see him.
Is he in Scotland?
He is, yeah. Uh-huh. And France, but he comes here too. Anyway, I've always approached books that way. On the one hand, there's the actually what they're saying that is concrete and mm-hmm. maybe sensible sometimes, but there's also just the language washing over you. Sometimes I pay attention for plot and sometimes I don't and just experience it.
The timbre of the words, how the lilting. And who reads it?
It's like, do you approach a painting with your analytical hat on, or do you just approach and let it fall over, you know?
Can be both.
Come to you. And I want to do both.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a nice reference to what we were talking about in your high school of the vocational and the academic. It's the immersive emotion and craft mm-hmm. and technical ability. With also the intellectual ability, mm-hmm. the history, the tradition of how we came to see X painting. Yeah. Or what is one of your favorite paintings?
Difficult question.
Give me several. Let's not pick one. And why?
I mean, one of the paintings that continues to strike me is by Fra Angelico. Uh-huh. It's Renaissance time painting, and it's the Annunciation. It's not that painting I love so much. It's just that what that painting does for me, it's not necessarily particularly about the object or the colors or the forms in the painting. It's mm-hmm. about the message that it sent to me, which was that I saw two different versions of this painting in the same scene, the Annunciation. It's when Mary is fertilized by God, right? So
it's a sexual act. Yeah,
right?
That's a powerful message.
And so the artist would hide the sexuality within the painting so that it could be shown in public. It's very much coded. But you would see the folds of the drapery are very much body parts, you know, which you might imagine. And there's this sort of spark that's happening. The content is exciting and mythical.
Where was this painting?
I first was exposed to it in grad school in a class called Aesthetics in the Renaissance. And then I used the rest of my graduate school loan money to go to Europe and go see all of these things while they were still fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
And so he's got two different versions of it. And the great thing is one of them was made for the Vatican or some fancy place, right? And that one is very fancy, and it's gold leaf, and the architecture in the painting is very expensive looking and all that, and the colors are very rich and vibrant. And then the other one is in a very Spartan monastery where the monks would just sit on the floor or have a very humble bench. So the painting is made humble. And
Where is the monastery?
It's in Florence. I went and visited that. So the same scene and the same moment is changed depending on the location and the context in which it's going to be viewed. So it's the kind of appropriateness. And I've used that in my artwork and in landscape work, too, where you wouldn't put a shining bronze thing in the middle of a normal everyday neighborhood. It would be out of place. It would be this shining object in the middle of a normal human place, and it makes you feel shaggy. It adjusts to where it is.
David, the word context comes up. Context, meaning, and metaphor. That seems to be three conceptual words or physical mm-hmm. words in some sense. That are guiding principles.
Yeah, you know? And context, not just physical context, but also what's going on there.
Emotional, cultural.
What are the people thinking?
Yes.
What is happening here? What is right here and what's wrong here and all of those. Just
study.
Where it is.
Study. You have to study an area to know.
So you have to be available to listen to it or to see it. I can't just come upon a place and impose myself upon it. I could, but that's a whole different thing. I'm much more interested in trying to absorb a place and then to make something or do something that is for it or in tune with it.
Let's roll back. You said you went to graduate school. So you go to Santa Cruz. You're in a redwood forest.
Hmm.
Wonderful education.
I started off as a theater major, too. Actually.
And you're a theater major.
Yeah.
And are you a writer or a performer? What are you?
I was acting.
You were an actor.
It was a way of studying people and a way of having more experiences than I'd lived yet.
So embodying other voices.
It was just deep pretend. You know?
And was there a favorite play that you just thought was great?
I most enjoyed the student works that were more experimental and that would have good parts and bad parts. But you'd get to see someone who had written something for the first time and someone work with someone who was directing something for the first time. Mm-hmm. So as an actor to come in and get to support that was most exciting.
It strikes me here is that you have to listen, and you're a very good listener, I've noticed. You listen, whether it's birds or people or water movement or the grade of a hill, you listen both with your eyes and with your ears and with all your body parts.
Yeah. Oh, that reminds me of another book, Body Watching, it was called.
I see.
And I forget the author's name, I think Morris. He was a zoologist who approached humans through the same lens as a zoologist would approach animals. So just looking at human behavior, why do they wear the red lipstick? What are they trying to show? What is the attention they're trying to get and why? And how do they act when they're trying to attract a mate or whatever it is? Mm-hmm. So it was this sort of pulling back, observing orientation that I found exciting. I mean, I have a tendency, I can hermit out for sure and stay in that pullback mode, but I've definitely chosen to engage in my life. But I find that I'm always flipping back between these modes of pulling back, watching, observing, and then participating, and then pulling back and seeing if it worked or was helpful or was what I thought it was, and then adapting and changing. Well, like a garden, I don't think should be finished necessarily. There's a work in progress aspect to
never most can be finished.
Right. It's like Gothic Cathedral. It's dead if it's finished. I learned, like, if you stop constructing it, it's dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's supposed to continue to grow, the flowers and the carvings, and it just continues and more and more and more and more and more. In this park project that I'm working on with other community members, that's been one of our things, is to have it never be finished.
Let's jump back a little bit on this one. You're in graduate school. You finished graduate school. Is it a graduate school for art?
Well, I finished my undergrad, and then I went to apprenticeships for other people.
Doing what?
I wanted to learn more about metal sculpture and making metal, you know, furniture and blacksmithing and all of that stuff.
Why metal?
Because I was excited by the fact that it transforms with heat. It becomes liquid and flexible and yet is a very hard thing. So that's exciting to me that you can change the state of matter.
Metallurgy, yeah.
Yeah, I liked that there's sort of a romance part of that. But also
alchemy.
Yeah, alchemy. But also as a material for making art, it's one of the most free materials because it's the stuff you use to support other artwork when it can't support itself. So it can reach all the way out.
What does that mean to a structure?
Like a metal can cantilever out, for example. Yeah. If you're working in clay or you're working in plaster, its limitations dictate part of how you behave with it. And so it wants to stay as a mass. That's where it's happiest. Whereas metal can be very happy as one mass, or it can be very much reaching out.
Like a bridge.
So there's a kind of freedom I found with metal. I could draw freely, and I could bring that into three-dimensional space.
How did you find these people to work with? I mean, were they listed? Did they have job listings?
Remember when they had newspapers? The want ads.
So wanted, it was like, metal.
Yeah, Hungarian blacksmith, gypsy blacksmith looking for apprentice.
I see.
Or Art Nouveau furniture guy looking for person to help. And so I would answer those ads because I needed to make money. And I had a skill set that allowed me to just not start at the very, very bottom. And then I could dive in and work with these people for 6 months or a year and learn a lot.
So you were focused, because there is the route also in working in metal of union, going into the unions and doing an apprenticeship program. There are are wonderful unions that have this.
Some of the best craftspeople are in those.
Craftspeople, we know.
Yeah.
And then there is the other union of artists, which is an invisible union.
Yeah. I kind of felt like I needed to get some of these skills so that I had a
Were you in the artist
viable
union?
Plan.
Yeah.
I loved making sculpture, but it was not a practical way to make money today or this week. So with blacksmithing and with architectural metalwork, I could go get work.
What is blacksmithing?
Blacksmithing is heating metal up hot and then hitting it with a hammer to shape it.
Sounds like fun.
It's like clay.
What do you do?
Like a wrought iron gate that has the scroll work and the thin stuff. It goes from thick to thin. That's blacksmithing. Most of that stuff I don't like at all, personally, in terms of my own taste. But I love the technique.
Sounds like you could do it, though.
I do it all the time. I mean, I have a full blacksmithing setup.
It's like Gaudi.
A metal sculptor. It's like Gaudi. Gaudi had a team of 100 fantastic blacksmith craftspeople doing dragons and all that stuff. And while I don't make dragons myself, it's a technique that's really useful.
If you were to make a dragon.
I was to make a dragon. Yes. But I used it to make gates and coat hooks and toilet paper holders. I would even sell
dragons
hooks
of utility.
At farmers markets. Yeah.
And what in farmers?
I was even selling hooks at farmers markets. I found out that you could go to a farmers market and get a booth for $20 a day.
Uh-huh.
And then I could put out 30 hooks that I had made.
And where
everybody
was
needs
this?
Another coat hook. And so people would pick one up just for the memory.
Is this in San Francisco?
San Francisco, all over the place. You're driving around with your wares. Very medieval.
It strikes me that you have the Alvin Duskin entrepreneurial gene.
Yeah.
This is terrific.
Well, he failed so often that it became okay. And so there was no expectation that I had to do something and it had to work out necessarily. I had to just keep doing stuff and something would work out. And so I was not really afraid of risk.
Mm-hmm.
And while they weren't super wealthy, there was always a place I could go and crash and recover if I had to, if things didn't work out tragically. But luckily they did.
Well, you just kept at it. I mean, just hammering away.
You just didn't stop. Yeah. And so for many years, I moved up into the mountains near Tahoe and got tons of work up there because everybody had their third home in Tahoe and needed metal
more
work.
Hooks.
They always needed stone and metal and wood. And so that was nice and steady work. So I did that for five
or
6 years.
There?
I didn't want to be in the city anymore. And it was really hard to get workspace here. I had been living in Alameda for a while, and studio options were places with razor wire and landlords that had a gun for protection. The things I could afford at that moment
were either
industrial or very rural. And so I moved to a town, 4 hours away, which meant for $650 a month, I could have 3,000 square feet of space. Mm-hmm. And I had saved up enough money that I could try starting my own business and running that.
Were you by yourself? Were you just on your own?
I was with a woman at the time, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we went together and sort of launched that whole venture and ran that for 5 or 6 years.
Good. So you had a teammate and you were a partner and you were working.
It was
away
good.
There.
And I was able to develop a lot of skills that way and just cut my teeth and learn how to do a project and how to not be flaky and how to follow up and make a receipt. Anytime I would earn a little money, I would buy another tool. And so slowly you have more and more of what you need. And then I started thinking about how do I transition to doing more of the art and less of the functional stuff.
Was there a reason? Because some people continue to do stairways and wonderful things.
It's great. I just saw what success would look like if I kept on that path.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not exciting to me. I also disliked that if I did a project that was a functional thing, about 90% of my energy was spent on fulfilling the functional requirements.
Mm-hmm.
A gate has to be a gate and it has to stand up and move. And so most of your effort is towards that, generally. And so very rarely do you get to do a more fun one. And then there would be this small fraction of the design moment, the fun part, whereas sculpture is much more of the fun stuff.
So what is sculpture to you? That's a word we often hear. And what exactly is sculpture?
Well, some people say it's everything that is not painting, but now it is painting too. I teach sculpture too, so it really can be just about anything.
Where do you
Academy
teach?
Of Art University in San Francisco.
And you teach sculpture?
Sculpture, which is a very broad category. And I get the students when they're at the end of their undergrad or at the end of their grad, and they've taken all the prerequisites and they theoretically have all the skills and they've been given all the assignments and now it's time to do your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get them in this disoriented moment of what do I want to do, and the teacher is not going to give you an assignment. And so my job is not to instruct, it's just to be with them, show them how to figure stuff out, figure it out with them. And so sculpture is very, very broad. I mean, people are doing performance pieces, people are doing the traditional bronze figure, they're doing performance pieces, they're doing ephemeral events, which are just a moment, which may have an object involved or not. So it can just exist in the mind, or it can be about stuff.
Mm-hmm. So and stuff is what?
It can be about making things, the beautiful thing, or making the beautiful thing, or the shocking thing, or the object. It's object making, which I'm so not interested in anymore. But that's generally what people consider sculpture, I would say.
And that's a big statement. I'm not so interested in that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really big sea change because you're making things that have been requested by an individual or a group or corporation, a city. and you start to shift, it sounds like. Am I right? That you're shifting to more conceptual work? What is the shift going toward?
I think in the beginning, I was really interested in the making stuff part because I needed to learn that for my own adventure. I don't know if you ever finish it, but I wanted to bring my skill set up until whatever I wanted to do, I could do. Mm-hmm. And that is very satisfying. And I think if I hadn't done that, I would not be satisfied. But once I got to that point, it became much less interesting. It's just, well, do it again, do it again, do it again. So now the object making is something that I still do. It's an excuse for why people pay me. But it's not the goal I'm driving for anymore. For example, if I do a commission on someone's property, the piece is really the excuse for the relationship and the happening of meeting this other person, getting them to engage with their landscape better, me getting to observe their landscape and them in it, and all of that stuff. And so the object becomes just the evidence that's sort of left.
You're making objects in the Sierra Nevadas, it sounds like. Is that where you are?
I was at that time, yeah.
Yeah, and you relocate
down to San Francisco.
To San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
To go to grad school.
To go to grad school. You go to grad school. If I may paraphrase this, it sounds like you've learned the grammar of metal and sculpture, and you really want to write that narrative. Now, is that correct?
Yeah, I had been doing my work for long enough that I realized all the things that I didn't know, all the materials I didn't know anything about, and the ways of making and being that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. So school was a very practical way to get that knowledge. I knew I would have a bunch of other adults in the room I could start asking questions of.
So you finish graduate school, and then what happens?
Well, partway through grad school, I got my first public art project. Part of why I went to that school was they had a public art class, which taught you how to do the public art
process. And this was at the Academy of Art.
Yeah.
Sounds very helpful.
It was very helpful because I didn't want to go the gallery track, and this was a concrete way to, one might
And you didn't want to go on the gallery track? That's a big decision.
I think it was because I had studied theater before, and I had walked away from it. It became less fun because it was really fun for me as a young person, and as an adult, when it started to become the adult world of acting, that was about who you know and what opportunity happened to fall into your lap. Well, someone else was always the gatekeeper. Can't do my work unless I get through this thing or massage this ego or make a connection with that person. And it kind of polluted the discipline for me and made me think.
Third party.
I love doing plays, but I'd rather make my living mowing lawns than pollute this thing that I love. So part of why I didn't want to go into the gallery track for art making was because it was always about being liked, having the work be wanted or valuable, or having gone to the right school or having known the right person or be in the right gallery. It's this whole hustle, but someone else is always the gatekeeper.
Would you say you wanted to be your own gatekeeper?
I didn't want gates.
You didn't want gates. And great answer. I love that. That's terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was not attached to a particular level of success. I was just attached to, like, I want to be able to live and eat and sleep and buy clothes and stuff. I was not attached to any particular financial goal. That to me is enough of an accomplishment.
So you get your first public art commission.
Yeah. Because as a class, the class was to compete for a real life project. And so we did. And I got it, which was a surprise. And so then the whole class next semester rallied around this project and we all pulled it off and did it together.
What was it?
It was called Teaching Stones for a wonderful teacher and librarian in San Jose, Doris Dillon. It's at the San Jose Almaden Library and Community Center. And she was a very loved teacher and reading specialist. She was known for making learning fun. Like, you'd go to her classroom and read and there'd be popcorn. It was just all turned into games and not the way education can be of, I'm embarrassed that I can't read well or whatever it is. And so the point of this project was to memorialize and honor this woman who was very loved by the community. But at the same time, many of the people approaching the place that we ended up making had never known her. So it had to work for those that were really close and those that didn't know her at all. Mm-hmm. And the goal was to try to continue her work. So we put in these boulders, one boulder for each part of speech. So there was like a verb boulder and a noun boulder and an article boulder. And they were carved with words that she had said or things that people said about her. So if you knew her, you'd hear popcorn and you'd get that kind of echo because you knew that was something. If you didn't know her, fine, popcorn. But then the kids could go around from the school and the library and the community center, and they'd go with crayons and they'd rub on these words. And you'd go from stone to stone trying to make a sentence, and you'd realize there's a physical relationship. But I have to go to this stone for A, an, you know, for certain things, and over here for the verbs, and over here for the adjectives. And then sometimes a word occurs on two stones. So this would have helped me tremendously learning grammar because I was terrible at it. So it was making learning a game, trying to continue her tradition. But also it was a place where you could just go and sit on the stones.
Your description, I want to go. I want to go to this library. Yeah, it's the Almaden?
Almaden Library and Almaden Community Center. It's called Teaching Stones. And that was a very collaborative project. Even though this piece of my sketch got the project, we had pre-planned that if it came through for anyone, we would all join and do it together.
How many of you are there in this class?
There was like 8 of us. And then we also had the teacher, who was an artist / architect. And so it was all collaborative. It was all mixy. And it was
Who was your teacher?
Donna Schumacher is her name. Uh-huh. And so it wasn't particularly my authorship or their authorship. It was just an us thing. Different from a gallery situation, right?
Was that important that it wasn't...
It was ensemble. It was like being in a play. We were all working on something together that wasn't about me or us or...
And that's important
to
you.
It was us doing something.
Yeah. David Duskin Stones wasn't going to be...
I could really care less, you know.
What you were hoping for.
Yeah. The fun was to be on a project with people, mm-hmm. collaborating, and then to be together, seeing it get finished, and then to see people coming out and sitting on them, and then see people doing the rubbings. I mean, that's the gratification, I think. In public art like that, nobody looks at the nameplate. Who cares?
What I find terrific in this conversation is that I realize as I look out to my left and I see an island, that this is in parallel with your first public art commission. Mm. That, in a sense, all these years you've been growing your skill sets, and now with your wife, Darlene Gonzalez, who's also an artist, and that together you have created a quite extraordinary public art or public nature, public place. Park.
Yeah.
Sure. And the name of this is a park, right?
Yeah, it's Petaluma River Park.
Petaluma River Park. If we make... Could we jump forward to how this all started, this park? And how big is this island?
It's not really an island, but it feels like an island, which is part of the magic. Yeah. It also feels kind of like being on a big boat.
It does look
when
like
you're
a
there.
Boat.
It's got a bow and everything on the far end. It's like the Titanic moment out there. Well, one of the things I found out working with people is that everybody has a different origin story.
Yes.
And usually they're at the center of it, you know. The best I could tell you is the origin story from my perspective was that Darling and I had worked on another project with another friend of ours. Again, collaboration, teamwork, which was in Castro Valley Library. What happened there was a creek had been running through a pipe underground, and the creek was daylighted, and the landscape was restored on either side. You know, the earth was pulled back, and plants put in, and paths put in, and a library, and a playground, and outdoor classrooms, and all this stuff. And Darling and I and the other people we were working with got this project.
Got it means you competed for
it. We competed for it, yeah. It's all competitions.
This is public,
public art. Yeah, competitions. So the initial ask was for some fencing to keep people out of the sensitive creek habitat, but with ways in so that you could go in and bring a group of students into the creek habitat. And so the design challenge there, at least from our perspective, was how do you make a fence? What you really want is not a fence. The last thing you want is a fence.
Challenge.
So, yeah. And I think the reason we got the project was because we designed a very open air situation. It was like ranch fencing, so that thin galvanized wire, so as light as it could be. And it took you back to the old ranchy days, which did occur at that place, were part of the history of the place. So that resonated with some community members. And then we made it look like a falling down fence. So where all the posts, you know how they age and then they all start to sort of cascade. And that's so beautiful.
It's like a wave.
It's so beautiful. Yeah, and I see that on my drive to my studio every day. And it
was your studio's in Tamales.
In Tamales, yeah. Right. So I drive from Petaluma out to Tamales, and it's like you go through Ireland on the way, basically. And all these fences are falling down in this state of beautiful aging, much nicer than they are when they're new. So we made a fence there that looked like it was falling down, and it had some blacksmithing parts and had this wire. And then we ended up doing a bridge out of an old railroad car, and then Darling did all the illustrations and the signage and the seating and
Darling's a very everything. Good drawer.
So she comes from industrial design background, mm-hmm. and she's also taught at the university level. And then when we started connecting and working together.
In Manila, didn't she?
In Manila, yeah. The University mm-hmm. of Manila. She was running industrial design department there. And so we met. She was sent on full scholarship to anywhere she wanted to go in the country for grad school. She did, and then happened to meet her there.
You met her?
In grad school.
Oh, in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
Oh, in San Francisco. Yeah. Okay.
Somehow. So having done this project in Castro Valley and seen a creek daylighted and a landscape restored and then the public come back and then sit there and soak it in and get everything we had put into the project they were receiving. And it worked. And because we were able to, in the end, do everything there and not order anything out of a catalog, we never broke the spell. So that was the last thing I wanted
to... Was that important to you, not really to order important. If you're anything gonna, from a catalog?
I think if you're going to bring people to the edge of a river and you want them to have an experience with nature, and that's the whole point, mm-hmm. what you really want is nothing added. Mm-hmm. But because this is a public library and a civic space, mm-hmm. the rules said certain things had to be added. So the trick was, how do we do these things, like an ADA bench, without it coming out of a catalog and sort of making you snap out of that natural experience? I very much dislike walking through a park and you come upon a piece of chain link fencing, especially if it's brand new. If it's old and stuff's growing through it, maybe, but when it's brand new, it kind of pops you out of the dream, out of the state.
Out of the romantic idea of the park that
yeah,
you're in.
Right.
Yes.
So having witnessed that transformation, we were coming off of that and it made us interested in this piece of property.
So you come from Castro Valley, where you're doing basically bringing people to a place. You're making a place for people.
It was really place making.
Placemaking, yeah. I mean, that's a word we hear often.
And it was sculptural and functional.
You're integrating your skill sets, your imagination, your ability practically mm-hmm. to make things mm-hmm. and to also satisfy a brief for the public. That's a very complicated negotiation.
It is, especially without having it come out awful in the end.
You know? Well, it sounds like it came out in a wonderful manner and people were very appreciative.
Yeah, and we had to work with the librarians and all of the library community, the school community, the shelterless community there, public works, on and on and on, all these different agencies.
How many meetings did you have?
I don't know, 50 meetings or something. It just went on and on. It was an act of perseverance. It started off as a small project, and then they saw what we were doing, and public works said, how about do some more further down, and how about do some more? And it just kept growing and growing. It started off as a job that would have taken 6 months or a year and turned into a six-year project or something. Things kept happening. Like, they said, we want a bridge. We're going to order a bridge. And I said, I understand. Let us take a look at that first. And we found a way to make a bridge that was within their budget, but wasn't a bridge that had to be built from scratch.
I think, David, you're also building relationships. You and Darling are building relationships of trust. And it is that variability that you have on the practical end, which is this team knows how to build within yeah. a budget.
Right.
And they are listening to us.
Mm. That still surprises me that they actually listen.
You're listening and they're listening. You're both listening. Mm. And that's communication, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not listening, well, what are you communicating with? I mean, you're just listening to your own story then. It's a tape. It's just going to keep going.
Yeah.
Could be a good tape. Could be a bad tape. But it's just your tape. So you come through the 6 years of public works. You're naming a number of agencies that... Mm. cities have that are helpful to them. And here you are in Petaluma. You've moved here. You have a family here now.
Mm-hmm.
And how does this peninsula appear? I mean, it's
there was actually,
kind of large.
Yeah.
How large is this?
It's just over 24 acres.
Are you walking one day and you think, gosh.
So two things happened.
Gosh,
so,
an island.
Yeah. Just exploring the town. We had kind of seen it, but couldn't go over there because there was a fence blocking you because it
how
was
many years
privately
ago
owned.
This?
Maybe 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
It was privately owned and the fence was there and so we didn't
cross
in.
The chain link fence.
Yeah. It always struck me as very strange that you had this big patch of blank cattle grazed land in the middle of a city.
Isn't this in the middle of a river too?
Yeah, this is the Petaluma River, which is right in the middle of downtown Petaluma. So to have a big green space that was
24 acres
vacant right in the middle of is rare. And also to have a place where you have views of water on all sides is very rare. And then the topography is not very extreme, so it's also kind of makes it all doable.
Is this low tide all, that we're looking at?
We're on the higher side, but it's 11 to 14 feet on average above sea level. So it's enough that most of Petaluma will be underwater before the park is.
So you and your friend are walking. It's 10 years ago, and there's a chain link fence, and they're 24 acres.
That was Darlene and I. We saw it and thought it was amazing, but didn't really take any note of it besides what a cool spot. And then many years later, two things sort of happened simultaneously. An artist friend of mine and I were sitting in on all the public art meetings for this town because they had a new public art committee that clearly needed help. And so we wanted to help and sit in. And this piece of land got brought up as maybe you should put something out there, but it was owned by someone else. So the idea was dropped.
Sitting in, are you on the board of a public?
No, we were just a citizen.
Public artist, artists with a lot of experience. You're there to offer your help.
We just sat there and said, look, let me connect you to this other agency that's been doing it for 30 years really well, or my advice is this or that, whatever. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to join the committee because then we couldn't participate in projects should they happen. So it kind of came on my radar in that way. But also, Darling and I were driving or walking by, I don't remember, and there was a billboard from a realtor with a drone photograph of this peninsula, and it said, for sale.
Are you walking with your children? You just kind of walking around?
Yeah, I don't even remember. Yeah. I just remember seeing this sign with this big slice of this beautiful peninsula surrounded by the river with a for sale thing on it. And I remember Darlene and I joked, wouldn't that be great? If only we had enough to get something like that, and we could make art and make a park and have a community place and all these things. If only. And so then called the realtor, and not seriously, I just sort of wanted to know because you might as well cross that off the list as undoable. And it turned out it became doable.
So what was the sale price?
It was just over $1 million because it was
zoned. For 24 acres.
Yeah, wow. Because it had been zoned park and rec and so could not be used agriculturally anymore and could not be built on or anything like that. And the comparables, there was nothing to compare it to.
So were they thinking golf course or what were they thinking?
The city could have bought it and turned it into a public park, but the city didn't have the bandwidth or the money for it at the time. Somebody else was looking at it. This was maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
Someone else was looking at it, apparently, the realtor told me. A wealthy person from LA who might buy it for his son, who could fulfill the commitment by having it open to the public once or twice a week or per month even, and then could have celebrity chefs out there, and then he was going to have a fake Miwok village for glamping. That induced a lot of fear in us. It just seemed like this should be a public resource and should be done well and should not be taken in that direction. And the price being what it was, and having worked with clients I've worked with, I knew that for the right people, it could be an impulse buy even. And that would be terrible for this town. So we started asking friends and talking it up, and people sort of joined our team, and we were asking questions and asking other realtors.
How many people joined your team?
It started off just 4 founders. So it was Darling and I and my friend Sean Paul and his wife Sierra, and they were both born and raised in Petaluma, so they were really entrenched locals. So they had all the local connections.
How old are they?
They're about 10 years younger than us, so they're in their 30s, okay. Millennials. And then we had an angel investor who came in with a small chunk of money that...
What's a small chunk of money?
It was like $20,000. I mean, relative to the venture here, it was a small chunk.
And was and this that allowed a family member? Maybe there are other people who like to do this that are listening.
Mm-hmm.
Is this person a client or a family member? Did the person come out of the sky? How did this person
We had
appear?
Met them through sitting in at the public art committee. It was another member of our community that just said, hey, I have a little extra. And she caught wind of what we were thinking about doing and was interested in the sculpture possibilities.
Are you a nonprofit so that they could write this off, this angel investment?
So I immediately went and got the Nolo book on how to run a nonprofit and studied the whole thing and read it and highlighted it.
Folks out there, this is Nolo Press out of Berkeley.
Yeah.
This is a wonderful publishing house that will teach you pretty much anything if you can read.
It was great. It was like, told me, what's a board? What are their functions? What kinds of nonprofits are there? How do you do it? What do you do? What do you not do? So we took this little piece of seed cash and we got a local lawyer who had helped other nonprofits to help us set it up.
Did they charge you?
He did not. Okay. Everybody told us to get a fiscal sponsor and partner with another nonprofit, which often new nonprofits do, but then they take a percentage and just decided not to do that. We just decided to become our own nonprofit right away.
So folks out there, a fiscal nonprofit, do you want to explain what that is?
A fiscal sponsor, what they do is it's a nonprofit that helps other nonprofits get started. So you've got a group of people and they have an idea and they want to start a nonprofit. And there's all this paperwork and business stuff and financial stuff, which they usually do terribly. And so they act illegally and can't get donations, and the whole thing stumbles. So the solution to that is there's nonprofits that are serve as fiscal sponsors. So you basically run your nonprofit through them. So the donations go to them, and then they get cycled back to you. And for that service, they take a percentage, like 5%, 10%. It's a great way to start a nonprofit. And then maybe 5 years, 10 years later, you do the paperwork yourself and you have your own nonprofit, but then you have to be able to send all the right paperwork to the government and do everything.
It's management. Correct. They're managers.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just decided to skip that intermediate phase because we thought it would be better to go for it all the way. And then we had 400 donors. We threw a party. We had a gathering where we
Where was the gathering?
It was right here over near our office on a lawn, not even an in inside space, over around the corner there where
you could see the land.
We asked the people that owned the building, could we use your lawn? We're trying to get something going. They said
yes. It's this building we're in now.
Yeah. And so we did a slideshow and a talk, and you could look over and see the property. And then we had an auction just to sort of get it all going. As a result of all that stuff, we ended up with 500 or so donors right away that raised all the money and bought the land. And there were a lot of $4 donors, $6 donors, $15. And that is tremendously significant because the higher dollar donors only came in when they saw the community was engaged. And a lot of us think you can't donate unless you have blank amount of money, right? People think it's something that you do later when you arrive, and it's actually something you can do all the way through, because when we get donors that donate $2 to us, it makes a huge difference. It shows that you have the community support behind you, because big donors come and go.
How did you advertise your party? How do you get these people
Rewind a little bit. First, we had these sort of town hall meetings where we went to the public library. We said, can we have a thing in your public space? Of course you can. It's a public library. We had a slideshow and a talk.
Who made the slideshow?
Darling, of course. And then we made a 6-foot model out of oil-based clay of the land, the vision of how it would be with lots of trees and docks and paths and stuff, so we could kind of paint the picture.
How long did it take you to make the model?
Weeks. Luckily, Darling and I finished a project in Boston and then used that to buy some time to really focus on the work that had to be done to get this park project launched, which meant build a model, study the land.
And no one's paying you for this.
No, yeah. Study the land, build the model, change the model to show what it could become, document it, make drawings, make budgets, a whole proposal package similar to what you would do for a public art package. You got to paint the picture. You got to have some tasty visuals. You got to break down some details, show how it could play out over time. And of course, that's not exactly what happened, but we had to paint the picture. We had to generate the content, the visual.
As you talk, David, I am listening to you and I see that all your background, all of the work that you've done over the years, the competitions are in a sense prepping you for this, frankly, enormous effort to purchase 24 acres in the center of a vibrant city, a large city actually, and to involve the community, knowing to go to the library, knowing to have a visual show that it's actually working, the projectors are working, there's a sequence, it's legible.
Yeah, we had to do it in a high quality way, because if we'd done it in a mediocre way, I don't think it would have worked as well, or maybe not at all. The fact that Darling did beautiful visuals and not just visuals that were okay and worked led to the snowball, the chain reaction. If we tried to do everything at the highest quality that we could, it meant that the doors kept opening up.
I'm also struck that your client is the public.
Yeah, it's a park for people, art, and nature, we say. So the public is our client, and also the animals and the life forms on the property are our clients. So we can't build just for people.
Right. It's a holistic biodiversity of life.
If we do our job well, we'll see more people out there. We'll see more plants out there. We'll see more birds out there. Those are all measurable things. And we need all of them. Otherwise, we need to make an adjustment. So one of the first things we did out here was a biological survey.
How did you even come to
this idea? Well, I didn't know any of this, but I do know how to ask questions and to find people. So I started asking around about who are landscape architects that are restoration specialists that think about this stuff, and it's their passion, eroding banks.
Experts.
And stuff. Yeah.
Of some kind. Who were they? Who did you...
They're called PCI, Pronuski Chatham Inc., and they do lots of work in this area. And then there's another organization called Point Blue, and they have a STRAW program.
What does that mean,
STRAW program? It's a program where they take students out into the field and plant trees and repair a watershed, basically. And so I went and volunteered for these things as a way of studying.
Are they landscape architects, Point Blue?
No, they're a restoration nonprofit organization that does lots of restoration all over the place.
And all over the place is California?
California, as far as I know. And then Sonoma Land Trust, contacted them, just sort of went to their offices. I have questions. We have an opportunity. Start gathering information. And people always give you names. And then I would actually follow up and listen to them. So it was really a matter of getting educated and really exciting to be on a learning curve again in a new discipline. And related where my skills could support it, but it was also a new thing to study.
And they were doing base map of what you have, in a sense.
So, back to the biological survey. So Pronuski Chatham Inc. advised that grants are part of how things get done in restoring land. We had just been going private, but the amount of stuff that you have to do to really do great restoration is expensive, and so there's grant money for that. And part of how you unlock grant money is by quantifying what's happening. So they recommended this, and so we had some money we had raised and used it to pay biologists to come out at various times of year and look at all the plants and all the animals and everything like that, and where's the wetlands, and start to map it. It's basically mapping.
What does this cost to have these people come?
Tens of thousands of dollars. Well, there's a whole series of them. Just the biological survey itself was maybe 10 or something. I'm not sure exactly.
Okay.
But there's biological surveys, there's cultural studies, there's archaeological studies, there's traffic studies, there's all these.
So did you do all these studies?
We're doing them slowly as needed, but the biological survey was important that it come right away as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then we installed a people counter so we could see how many people are coming. Because
a people counter?
Basically, it's a piece of wood with a camera. It doesn't take pictures of you, but it recognizes a blob of heat moving past. So it can tell if it's a person or a cow or whatever. And so there's some margin of error. We don't know if we're counting people or cows. But you can see that, before we put up a sign that says, welcome, that only X amount of people were coming. And now more people are coming. And when we put out tables and umbrellas, more people are coming. And then when we have events, more people come. And so you want to quantify that and quantify how many more birds there are, which there already are, and otters that we see, et cetera.
And these are the biologists who are coming and making counts.
Biologists did these surveys, and we end up with this big stack of paperwork that says, here's what you've got out there. Here's what percentages.
Do they come many times a year, or do they come?
A few times a year, and especially when things are about to bloom, or they had to come and check that we weren't going to damage any goose nests and stuff like that. It's a whole expertise. But you end up with this list of here's what you've got now, so that you can see as you do the restoration or as you stop damaging the land and start healing it, you can see the transformation. Mm-hmm. We don't want to
skip any
part. Sounds
like a fixer-upper to me.
It is, yeah.
in real estate terms, this is known as a fixer-upper.
Yes, I like fixer-uppers. That was
big
my house too. Yeah. But the thing is, the goal is not to be fixed up. The goal is to let the public experience the whole thing.
Does the whole thing mean? What does that mean?
We wanted to invite the public here before anything had happened, which we did. Got lots and lots of people out there before we even put in a trail.
Was it a party, or how did they come?
We did. We would meet them on the first Saturday of every month, an open invitation that we would put out on social media and also signs at the library and talking to people and handing out pamphlets.
Is this you four doing this?
Well, very quickly we realized
4 to 40.
We can't do this by ourselves, right? So everybody started pulling in their friends, people that had different expertise that might be related. We had a city planner and a farmer and a school teacher and
a lot of coordination.
On and on and on, yeah, because there's all these different skill sets coming in, and we're trying to engage our whole community. So you also can't just be stuck in your own community's circle. So we had to do some outreach to other communities to make sure we are starting to communicate with them. So this team developed that we started to call the captains, and then it became bigger, and then we had different departments, like you guys are the ones that do events, and you guys are the ones that mow grass, and the stewards that fix stuff and do stuff out there. And
Each captain has a different special, a boat.
Roughly, yeah. And these are kind of like committees. And some people are on many of them. I'm on almost all of them. And then we have fundraising ones, and then financial ones, all the things that you need. We just had to break it up. This unmanageable, unwieldy thing, once we broke it up, became manageable. And so we realized, for example, we didn't have enough people on the team with financial backgrounds. So we only had one. And to lean on one person for that was not fair. So now we have a few, so they can work together and as a team and share responsibility.
So with this financial, what is it that you need from the financial people?
I thought it would be more like running my own business or our business.
Yeah.
It's not at all like the private sector. There's just more paperwork to do. There's a whole bunch of hoops you have to jump through to prove to be a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. State a mission and vision and values and how you're going to fulfill your mission. And then it has to be approved by the California state government and then the federal government. And then it's just a whole lot of stuff that kind of feels like taxes to me. But then the financial component is keeping track of people's donations, making sure that they get the information they need so they can do the write-off, figuring out how much you should ask people for.
Ongoing. This is ongoing.
You know, are we going to have ongoing donors that give us $10 a month forever, or big ones, or is that a bad strategy?
So it's a bit marketing, it sounds
Lots
like.
Of marketing. Our executive director, Sierra, who's one of the founders, her background is in both museum studies and marketing, and she worked at the Marin Headlands, and she's worked for food companies, but she's got a lot of marketing expertise, which has been really helpful to us.
Really?
Because it's communication.
Good preparation for this, yeah.
Yeah, it's all communication, and there's sort of a branding part. We have branding people on our team too. Some young people who are like in social media.
What do you mean by branding? How do you brand a park? Well, or is it the effort you're branding?
No,
or both?
It's sort of both. I mean, you have to come up with a logo. And what does the logo mean? And is it inclusive or is it exclusive? Is it a logo that resonates only with liberal white people? Or is it a logo that is also going to work for our Latinx community? What kind of feeling does it give? If it's too naturey and too eco, that drives away our donors that are in business. So it's just very complicated.
Do you have swag? I mean, do you have things like bags and t-shirts and things like this?
All those decisions have to be made. As an environmental organization, we don't want to produce a bunch of stuff that goes in the trash, right?
It's all recycled.
People want swag, but yet you don't want to create too much swag. So how do we navigate that? If you are going to have swag, how is it going to be the good stuff, the stuff that people want? You know, we did like little pins, low impact swag as much as possible, or t-shirts that our volunteers wear as a way of noticing them and thanking them. But we've had to hold back from over swagging it because pretty soon you're at some place picking up boxes of stuff that you know is going to end up in the landfill. And it's not really what people want. What people want is the experience of participating. This all got launched during COVID, so people were really valuing outdoor space. Mm-hmm. We thought it was going to be a stumble, but it wasn't. And what people want is connection with others, and they want to do something that's concrete that they can come back to and say, I was part of doing that. Mm-hmm. And we get lots of volunteers, many who are already in this town, but also lots of people that are just moving to this town and want to build community as a way to do it. And then we also have lots of volunteers who are otherwise successful, it would seem, but they haven't had a give back part of their lives yet. And so this is a very concrete way to give back. The thing is that we have a smart train here now, public transportation. So we're going to be drawing from everywhere in Sonoma County. And also this connects to the Bay Area. You can get a group of kids on a ferry in Oakland and get them here, ferry to the smart train, and then they're in Petaluma. So we're also within range for field trips for lots of places. So we're not thinking of the park as a thing that's for Petaluma.
It has it's the pebble in the pond. There are a lot of ripples.
Things are getting closer and closer together, and the public transportation is making that more and more possible.
So it sounds like you're at a junction now where you are the director, right?
I'm the chair of the board.
You're the chair of the board.
So we have an executive director, and so she's full-time.
Is this one of the founders?
Yeah. And then another person who was one of our volunteers, who was a fundraiser for the Green Music Center.
What is that?
It's a place where they do performances. It's in Sonoma County. It's just north up the highway a little bit. So they have all sorts of performances. It's called the Green Music Center. symphony, jazz, indoor, outdoor, all of that. She's fantastic to work with, so we convinced her to come and work with us instead. So she's doing that full time now, and then we have a new intern here, and
more and more volunteers.
So the equitable thing to do is we create job descriptions. So you can't just hire from within and think that's okay.
Okay.
Because that's not fair. You're not giving anyone else a chance.
That's a good point, right.
And then also it would seem that you had created a job and a salary based around
wanting
to give your friend a job, right? So instead we would create job descriptions. And we do this for our volunteers too. We say, here's what we need. We create a formal job description and then we put it out and post it on all sorts of sites and at universities. For our intern, we post it at the junior college and at Sonoma State and then any other networks anyone can think of.
It's both. Not just Instagram and Facebook and
No, it's
Twitter.
Also a printout on a corkboard somewhere. Because if you just do Instagram, Facebook, then you're excluding all of those that don't participate in those formats.
So it really is inclusive.
It's got to be both in terms of language and also location. I mean, we're trying to make the pay scale be such that it's a real job. It's not a compromise job. I'm really tired of that thing of, well, I'm in the nonprofit sector, so I have to accept less money. I don't think that's right.
And is the intern paid?
Mm-hmm. We even formed a coalition of other nonprofits to come together and just help us think and talk about what we should do and how we should reach out to all members of our community without missing. So we identified a bunch of other nonprofits and they all came to the table to talk to us and tell us what we were doing wrong and what we were doing right and what we should do and et cetera. And we paid them to come to those meetings because otherwise only those that can afford to have free time come to meetings. So you end up with this filter.
What do you pay someone to come to a meeting?
$20 an hour or whatever. I didn't set the numbers. It's not a sacrifice for them to come. If you want their information,
it is very important. That's correct.
How do I contact your community? I need to respect your time and so pay you for it so you can afford to show up. And also then you can ask them to do some homework.
Quid pro quo.
Mm-hmm.
And an intern, how much do you pay an intern?
CRED. Set that up. Basically, when we're trying to figure out what to pay people, we look at what other nonprofits are doing to try to see what's competitive and fair.
Mm-hmm.
We look at what that same skill set would be in the private sector, and then we try to land very competitively and offer benefits and all the things so that you
So you offer benefits?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. Full benefits. We want it to be a real job that you can do, and it's not a compromise or a sacrifice. In order to work here, my spouse is a little bit irritated because I'm not making as much as I should or could or whatever. Can't go to the dentist because I work at a nonprofit. You know.
What is full benefits? What does that mean?
Well, it's different for different organizations.
What is it for you?
For us, we want to pay them for everything they do and not have them stressed out about their health situation. So what we decided was we would pay either comprehensive medical and dental coverage. The thing we didn't like about that was that we would have to sign up for a set plan. What if they chose to do acupuncture or chiropractic or something that was outside of the field? So instead, we set up a thing where we bought a health plan and then you set up a separate fund that's just money they can use towards their health as they see fit for the year. And that's their decision. Otherwise, you're telling them you can't get a massage. What if they need counseling? What if they want to go to a therapy session for their mental health? Well, that's in our interest as an organization to have everybody well.
This is very responsible.
The nice thing is because it's a startup, you can just make it up. We decided from the beginning we want to try to do the right thing every time at every turn, whatever that is. And if we can't do the right thing, let's just slow down. And that's okay too. We wrote into our strategic plan that we would take our time is one of our values.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with landscapes and placemaking in the public art world and the private world, there's always this, let's get it done, let's roll it out fast, like that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's always a great thing. I think rolling things out slow is sometimes just right. I appreciate that the property that my mom's on, it started off as not a nice property, very neglected, and it's been many years over time and works of the hand that the garden has evolved. And that's the pleasure. So we don't want to skip any steps.
What I'm particularly struck by here is the amount of effort that has been expended by your foundation to responsibly run this organization. And I say that in the sense that your advertisements are not just Facebook and Instagram. You've come together to think about universities, multiple languages,
mm-hmm.
they're paid. I believe there's actually a law now that you actually mm-hmm. do have to pay interns, which is good. Mm-hmm. But you've been inclusive of social programs as well as the physical programs. The physical program being the peninsula, the park.
Yeah.
But there is a marriage here that is balanced out with those who will make this park successful to people as a public asset.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very thoughtful. It seems to me to be a banner that we should all stand behind.
Yeah.
And those of you listening who are contemplating this type of effort for your own communities, this is a good thing to hear, I think. What does it take? It's kind of like an octopus with 9 brains. Do they have 9 brains? I think they do. It's not one entity, and it's not just one wealthy donor, and it's not one wealthy city. It really is the $2 to $200,000 or more person. I'm struck by what you're saying. It is the $2 donor that we cherish, because that $2 is an extraordinary amount to that person. It's generous on their part.
Yeah.
When you have just enough.
You're probably saving for something. To have those people think of themselves as donors and part of what made it happen. It's true.
Yeah.
It feels good for people.
And the numbers is large that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do a GoFundMe? This seems to be very popular.
We didn't. We had lots of fundraising drives. A donor would give an amount and we'd have a match this amount fundraising drive.
Is that done on the internet? How's that
done? Sometimes it's on the internet. But we don't just do it through social media. It's always email and social media and paper mail.
It's like there's more feet on the ground with this. GoFundMes are great. And they're great to activate communities. But there's a bit of distance because of the internet.
Yeah.
This one seems to be, you're on the land, you're coming for a slideshow, you're in the library, coming for a slideshow. It's concrete.
It's real. And when it's GoFundMe, I know many people who just will never access that because they're just not going to go and figure out a new website.
Yeah.
So you really have to do both. It can't be either or anymore.
So where do you see yourself now? It sounds like this park has got legs and it's pretty well grounded.
Yeah, I think we do have good legs. I think we have a good backbone, good strategic plan and like values set and all of that stuff. So I'm definitely going to stay involved, at least in the near future. I can't imagine personally going full time at it because right now I'm also excited about being an artist and doing that.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. What are your...
So I do mostly public work, but also private stuff, always to do with landscapes, or usually to do with landscapes or places. Landscapes, both natural landscapes and urban landscapes, but to do with places.
Let's be specific. Can you share with us some of the public work you're doing?
For example, we're working on a project right now at the Oak Knoll Navy Medical Center. It used to be the Navy Medical Center.
Where is this?
It's in southern Oakland, in the hills, these rolling oak hills just past Oakland, and there was a call for entries for artists to compete for projects there, and 5 different artists or artist teams were awarded projects.
How do you find these calls?
A few different ways. Mostly it's sniffing around is how it starts. You look at any magazines that have to do with art or sculpture or anything might have listings. Then there's websites like one called callforentry.org or cafe.
So an artist can look on this.
You can look at calls all over the country and see which ones might be right for you. Some are for projects that you get paid. Some are for opportunities to participate in a show. It's all different things. And then eventually you get onto registries. There's several cities where now Darling and I are registered as artists that they've worked with before or been exposed to, and we're in a book that gets put in front of someone like, here's 100 artists you might want to pick
from. Is it 100 artists or something like this?
So like someone doing a project in a city where they have to spend 1%, for example, of the total budget on art is a law that often gets passed. Great law. So then whatever the budget is.
Is this a California law?
Not all of California. Like individual cities and towns have to pass them.
The 1%.
Yeah. So Emeryville, for example, has a 2% one, I think it is. And San Francisco has a 1%. The idea is this very small slice of the pie goes to support the arts, which increases vibrancy in the area, attracts business, attracts people, humanizes spaces, all of that stuff. And so they have to be put out as calls and you apply for them and everybody's open to apply for them. And you start by getting little small ones. And then eventually, once you prove that you can deliver on small ones, you're allowed to apply for bigger ones. So the project we're working on right now is in the southern Oakland Hills at Oak Knoll, what was a Navy Medical Center that was opened in response to Pearl Harbor. The Navy realized they needed hospitals and recovery places on the West Coast. And then the Navy didn't use the land for many years. And now some developers have bought the land 15 years ago, and they're turning it into neighborhoods with grocery stores and homes, and they have 7 different architects, so it doesn't look like all the same sprawl.
How big is this site?
The site is, I don't know, 400 acres or something like that.
It's quite a large
site. Yeah, and they have 70 acres of parks and trails, and it's all fully publicly accessible. Our culture is moving away from the gated community. People don't want that anymore. They want to be in a neighborhood that's permeable.
Close to the store.
It's not homogenous. Yeah. So in this site, there's an oak woodland, which has a mile of oak trees and rolling hills and then a creek down below it. And so the project that Darling and I are working on now is for that space.
Did you compete for that space?
Yeah, we wanted that one. Yeah. What they did was they have different budgets. They're very good about it. The smallest budget ones only go to very, very local artists, like in that town or in that town and the two towns next to it. And the next larger one goes to only California artists can apply. And the next one goes California, Nevada, the abutting states, and then there's the national ones. So as the budgets go up, the net gets bigger, which makes it fair and gives emerging artists opportunities.
Right.
Because the last thing you want is some New York artist doing a project in the middle of Oakland, and you're like, what? You don't get us at all, and how come you're not supporting our artists at all? So it seems like a good system. So Darling and I got one of the bigger projects in this oak woodland. So we're basically doing a series of inflated metal forms that are made of Corten steel. So steel with copper in it, so it rusts and stops rusting at a brightish orange. And it's got some stainless steel parts and then some boulders that are carved, so they are notched into the metal form. So there's these materials coming together in contact, touching and running into each other and then getting close to touching. And then there's a single bar of distressed painted white with nautical white paint, bar of steel that runs through the landscape, off and away from the trail. Kind of like the line in a hospital that reassures you that you're going the right place. And so you follow this through the landscape and it takes off like the travel path of a dog or a little kid. It's exuberant and wiggly sometimes. But the art really is taller and takes up more space in the beginning because at the trailhead area, you need to wave your arms and say, hey, come here. We're trying to attract people to come and be near the river and be in the oak trees. And once you get them and you hook them and they see the line running through the forest and they see the other pieces of sculpture there, it's like an Easter egg hunt. And it's sort of the bait that draws them along.
How wide is the line?
And they come up to a spot and turns out happens to be just the right height. I could sit on this. And it's rounded on top, so it's comfortable, but it's not a bench. But it's a sittable thing, like a nice, just the right stone. But it's oriented so there's a view of the river. So we think of it as a device to get certain behaviors.
Rounded. You're grounded. People. You stop.
Yeah.
But how wide is your line? Is it 1 inch, 2 inches?
Oh, the line itself is 1 inch by 2 inch solid steel bar. And it's all welded continuously and seamlessly. So you don't see the weld spots or anything. It just looks like one long piece of calligraphy. It's like a line drawing.
Signature.
In a way. Yeah.
The signature of an artist.
Because it's so heavy, because it's solid, when you connect hundreds of feet of it together, it becomes self-anchoring. So it's like a snake that lies in the landscape and can bend around trees. And when there's a rise in the land, you can walk on it like a balance beam.
How do you make this following a topology that's up and down and trees? How do you do that?
That's a tricky part. So two ways. One is the very tight bends. When the calligraphy is taking a tight turn or rotating or doing anything complicated, that stuff I'll do hot. So that's blacksmithing. I have custom forges built and adjustable things so you can heat up long pieces of a bar at once and then bend it.
Do you go on site to do this, or are you doing this in your shop?
On site, I make models and sketches and drawings with ropes and stuff to sort of figure out what I need to do. And then I go to my studio and make all the more complicated bends hot. But all the gradual bends, which are the majority of them, like where you'd have a long swooping line over the course of 200 feet, those are done cold and bent into the landscape. So the landscape becomes the tool that the metal is bent around.
And you do this physically in the land?
In the landscape. So
with a hammer? Or
no, we come out there, we start with 40-foot lengths of steel. We weld them all up into 120-foot bars, three pieces. Keep adding them together and you get these longer bars. And then it's like laying down a long stick, right? And then you grab one end of it. Now you have lots of leverage because it's 80 or 160 feet long, right? And you get 5 or 10 people to all walk to the left. And so we can now bend it into the landscape. And then we hold it there with straps. And then we weld the next 80 or 160 feet to that.
This is very physical.
Very physical, but it's very much collaboration with the landscape. It's not intellectual, theoretical, make it, come and place it, done. You've got to deal with what's there. And sometimes a tree's not there that was there when you first made a plan, and so you have to adjust. So it's dynamic and it's flexible, and it's not exactly what you planned, because I've planned lots of things. I know how to plan things and make them come out just like I planned. And I find that really boring now. It's much more interesting to have a scenario and an alphabet of tools and then to go in there and know you can adjust. It's like, don't follow the syllabus.
What got you to this idea of the line? What inspired you to make a line? Have you done this?
I've always loved lines. Part of it was born out of reading Moby Dick. And in Moby Dick, there's a lot of discussion about the line, the treacherous, wonderful line. So the line is the rope that connects the whaler to the whale.
So we want to say Moby Dick is a book by Herman Melville.
Herman Melville. It's about whaling. It's about the trade of whaling and about certain things that happen on a particular whaling adventure. And it's loosely based on reality. And it also kind of documents a whole lost trade, which I'm very interested in.
You're interested in the lost trades, trade?
Just trades in general and trades. How they become very specialized. Like any trade in particular has its own tools and its own ways and its own unique tools mm-hmm. that they make.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bookbinding is blacksmithing. It's all custom tools. You address your hammer, you shape your hammer, you deal with the handle. And there's all sorts of weird tricks that you'll learn from random people all over the world that do it their particular way. The Japanese mm-hmm. do it one way, and they do it different in South America than mm-hmm. they do in Germany. Mm-hmm. And yet they're all dealing with the same very simple problems in mm-hmm. a way. So the line kind of started with Moby Dick, or was crystallized by it, I would say. Because the line is the connection between the human and the divine natural being, which is represented as the white whale in the story. The human connection to nature is tight, sometimes it's loose, but it's very direct. And so through the rope, you're standing on the boat and the rope is there and you're touching it and you might get a rope burn from it, but it's connecting you to something hundreds of feet away. It's like a direct connection to the divine.
The whale is the divine, or are we the divine?
Yes, both. But metaphorically, in the book, the whale is a representative of the divine, the unknowable. It's treacherous. It's sometimes awful, sometimes wonderful. It's a killer. It's a blesser. It's very Old Testament, I guess. So that is part of where it came from. And then also, I was in upstate New York with a different friend I was collaborating with on a project, and we were trying to figure out how to help this client. He was having friends come to his landscape, this beautiful property, and they would just sit on the deck and drink martinis, and he wanted them to get into it, get out there. And he would always have to take them for a walk. He would have to lead them through. And so he would be the guide, and he didn't want to have to be the guide anymore. So this was a way of creating a guide. And through a single bar, you could set the tone, create a travel path, do things that were fun and light, and do things that are serious and straight. You could kind of do everything with one simple device. Ask anybody who draws. You can do everything with a line.
In upstate New York, how long is that line?
A mile or so.
That's quite a line.
Yeah, and it goes into the earth and comes out hundreds of feet later. It goes through a lake and comes out a few hundred feet later. You can walk on it like a balance beam across the lake. It actually floats in the middle of the lake.
Is this a metal piece?
Yeah.
It's...
And then it had to be grounded for lightning because there's lightning storms there. It comes out and becomes a fire pit when you need it to. Not really a fire pit, but it draws the ring that gestures where one would want to stay and linger and maybe have a fire.
What's the size of this line?
Same size, inch by two. What we wanted to do is find what is the smallest that would work. Definitely you could go bigger, and that's visually striking and all that, but it's more effort. So the smallest that would work and would read and be legible and would read his calligraphy and would hold up and be self-supporting.
So in a sense, you're Herman Melville. You're writing the line.
Yeah.
Literally, in nature. Are you the decision maker of where the line goes?
Definitely not. Because I know what I'll do.
So who makes the line?
The line is partly inspired by even the client's dog. We watched what his dog did when he ran off into the woods. Where does the dog go? When the kids come over, how do they run through the woods? Well, they run and they jump over this log and they jump off this rock and they do these things without thinking and without being designers. And so that's what it does.
But you are a decision maker.
I'm just trying to...
So a writer is a decision maker. You have a vocabulary. Mm-hmm. You have a lexicon, and you decide at a certain point, there are a lot of words out there.
Yeah, you have to decide whether to go right or left.
That's right, or center. It's an interesting position to
be in. I always feel like the decision comes at me. Even though I'm responsible for the decision, I feel like I have to show up enough to see where does the line want to go. Does it want to go right or left right now? And of course, I'm saying yes, and that's where it wants to go for me, for my vocabulary. But I'm trying to let it do what it most naturally wants to do. When we laid out how this line would go through the oak woodland in Oakland, it should be doing the most obvious and most natural thing possible, is what I'm aiming for.
Do you and Darling work together on these lines? How do you work as a team?
We occupy very different niches, but we work sort of separately together, mm-hmm. part of how I would describe it. Mm-hmm. I would say the most powerful thing we do is that we come together and check for understanding with each other or get critique from each other. Mm-hmm. Is this working? I think this is working. What do you think we should do? Or when you're at an impasse. Mm-hmm. And so it's great to have a partner who really trusts and who's taste I really believe in. So we help each other make decisions on our own separate branches of a project.
When you make the line in Oak Knoll, how long is this line?
This one's about a quarter mile.
And do you have to get permission from the developers, or do you put the line in and they say, oh, this is fabulous, good for you?
We have to make formal drawings like an engineer would do, drawings from different points of view, drawings calling out all the materials, written descriptions of what the maintenance would be for the piece, what the installation's going to look like, got to fit within a budget, all of that. And then goes run through an engineer and then goes to the city of Oakland. Part of the difficulty is how to keep it fresh and loose and flexible within this very rigid framework. I'll write into my contract description that it's going to be something very much like this, but not exactly like this. It's within this framework I'll have flexibility. Because otherwise, the design moments all happen before you do anything, and I want to be able to make a change at the last minute based on what's right.
What is the budget for this? Since it's a public piece, it'll be published.
Just under $300,000.
And that's for the line and the expanded pieces?
For the whole thing, yeah.
Quite a lot of work there.
It's a lot of work for that budget. This was one of the projects, Darlene and I get into this. Sometimes we'll find a project where it's such an opportunity that we say, let's give them way more than they could get for that kind of budget. So it's a stretch. So we'll make less on this one. Mm-hmm. But it's an opportunity to do something we've really wanted to do. It's a chance to do a piece like this on the West Coast. So my kids can go see it and friends and I can go visit it and all of that. So it's a bucket list project and it goes in the portfolio and leads to others. The way we think of it is some projects are keep the wheels turning and great opportunity and we have to get paid enough to live. And other projects are ones that actually have more profit built in. I was saying earlier, we came off of a more profitable project in Boston, which bought us a few months at least to focus on getting the park going.
And this is a very kind of janitorial question, but do you have to carry insurance for this?
Yeah.
The city doesn't, or the developers don't.
They may have their own, but we have to carry our own business insurance for all of our work that's we're currently doing. And think we can stop at some point, but I have no plan of that. So since the late 90s, we've just carried full public art insurance. It's like $2 million of liability or something. It's basically like if I'm negligent or I do a bad weld and don't fix it or mm-hmm. something really blatant like that.
Well, that won't happen with you.
No. So. It helps everybody sleep at night, and me too.
So as you accomplish this, how can the public see? Do you have a website?
Yeah. So the business is called Running with Sticks.
Where does that come from?
Running with Sticks comes from a piece of metal, like a 20-foot bar. We call it a stick. And running with sticks is something joyful and slightly dangerous, and it's something I tell my kids not to do, and yet that's exactly what I do. And we try to operate right on this edge. It's a little bit crazy and fun. And so the spirit of running with sticks, I love running with sticks. Who doesn't love running with sticks? So they can find it there. They can look up Running with Sticks on Google, or you can go to daviddeskin.com. That's another way to find it.
I think it'd be wonderful to see your work.
Yeah.
And this is a terrific connection for people. What I also want to mention one piece before we sign off here, and this is these air-infused pillows that you mm-hmm. make out of metal. I was stunned when I saw you make a piece, a show that we curated ourselves at Fort Mason. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you made.
It was four of these inflated metal forms. Basically, what you do is you weld together a hollow form. Like the simplest way to describe it would be as if you made a cube of six sheets of metal. Of course, I don't start with a cube. I start with a tweaked cube or something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's got seven or eight sides, whatever. But that idea of a hollow form. And then you cut a little hole in it and then weld a pipe to it and then inflate it with compressed air. And the way that it works is that compressed air is pushing from the inside on the metal. So it pushes those edges out, causes them to bow. So you started with a cube that has six flat sides, and then you add compressed air, puff it up, and then it will have six slightly curved sides. And so what it does for me is it makes it more boat-like. It makes it more animal-like, perhaps more like the side of a boat or the body of a whale or a person's body. The human body, when we're alive, we're always pushing out. The blood pushes the body out. I learned this in figure modeling. A lot of figure modeling is done by pushing from the inside out because someone deflates when they die. So the spark of life is to do with pushing out. So sometimes we inflate them a lot and they look like a pillow or like a Mylar balloon with the wrinkles and everything. But more recently, we've been doing just gentle inflation. So we get, over the course of maybe 10 feet, you might have 2 or 3 inches of curve push out. So you get these subtle curves. But what it does is it takes a form that would be hard and flat edged and faceted. It's got a coldness and a hardness to me. And it converts that form into something that's a little bit swollen, like a body.
It's sort of sinuous, very sensual.
Absolutely. And people are drawn to touch it. Sometimes they don't even realize their curve, but you put your hand on it and you feel it.
It looks like pregnant from Angelica. Belly,
side of a boat.
It reminds me of the painting that you like so much.
It's very sensuous. Sensuality is a big part of my creative practice, for sure.
But the contradiction is that it's metal.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's so exciting to see your pieces because they are metal, but yet they have this protuberance, this sort of sensual form, and they're floating.
That's the hard, soft thing. Yes. And then they float floating. And they do what they shouldn't do. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do a lot of what they shouldn't
do. We cut them up
do.
Afterwards. So then you get the flat cuts on the insides, like when you cut an apple or a piece of cheese or something.
How did you come to this idea to put air into metal?
It's not an original idea. I was at a blacksmithing conference, and there was an artist, a blacksmith there named Elizabeth Brim. She's fantastic. She was making metal hats and pillows and stuff like that. All this fabric stuff. So it's very kind of feminine imagery in metalwork at a blacksmithing conference.
What
I just
year was this?
Loved her from the beginning. It must have been early 2000s.
Where was this conference?
Either the one in Seattle, which is ABANA, the Association of North American Blacksmiths, something like that. Or it was the California branch, which would have been somewhere here in Sonoma County. So I went there, and you get to watch demonstrations of people work. And I went and just got hooked on her demonstrations. And what she was doing was welding sheets of stuff together, and then she would put them in the forge and make them red hot and then inflate them. And they go poof, and it was really exciting to be in the audience and see. And I love the unexpected quality to it, that you don't know what you're going to get out. Because all of metalwork is so controlling. It's like you plan it, you cut it, you make it, you sand it. You're in control the whole time. Well, this was an out-of-control moment where she would set up a situation, and then you kind of get what you get, and you got to go for it. And so it's really exciting. So I loved her forms, but I didn't want to make hats or pillows or anything like that. But I realized that I could apply those techniques to thicker material, and I could do it cold or hot. And then I started looking into it, and I saw people were doing it in different places in the world for different applications. Some people are even doing it for architectural applications. So instead of an I-beam, you can weld together two rectangles and then inflate it, and it becomes strong because it becomes three-dimensional.
How useful.
So we may see more inflated architecture. I mean, it's great for like stations on Mars and things like origami and inflated stuff. All these things where you make form from something that's more packable to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Flat packing.
And I saw it right away as a way to add life to something that's often dead, metal with the straight flat planes. I love doing clay and plaster work too, to start to bring those together, the softness of clay and plaster, which means curves come easily. The hard thing in clay is to not make the curve because your hand is curved. So this was a way that I could bring in some things I could get from other materials into the metalwork. Blacksmithing does it for steel too. You start with a bar that you get from a factory or steel yard, and you heat it up and you hammer it, and it starts to become soft. It becomes clay-like. It becomes human. It's no longer in a totally industrial language. It starts to get into a more natural language.
You know, there's this consistency in your integration of art and land. You're always touching, feeling sort of the temperature, the angles of the earth, what's growing. You're very in tune with the formation of earth. You're not a drawer and then you put it on, go out and see what the bulldozer did.
Yeah.
And I love that sort of silence with the land, that you're in some sense silent, although you are subtly shifting form. All of these actions are fairly subtle.
Yeah.
They're not big sheets of metal cut into the earth. They're very, very subtle. What does that come from?
I just consider myself a participant. I think that's where it comes from. Like, I want to participate in the world.
You don't want to control it.
I don't want to dominate it or conquer it. I think because I'd seen other men do that. I'd seen other artists do that, and I'd seen other adult males do that. And it just wasn't what I wanted to do, and it just wasn't me. I think it's just that I wanted to participate, and I appreciate the natural environment.
Well, David, I think we're very blessed to have you being an artist, a public artist, and giving of yourself and your wife, Darling Gonzalez, as well, your community. Because without you, we don't have the park.
Ah, well, it's without many, though, really. I was an instigator, but it is a huge team that's...
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But still, without you and Darling seeing a sign that, oh my gosh, up for sale, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
And also a park in Oakland Hills that an individual groups are taken down a pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And they find their own relationship to the earth. They're not didactically told this is a sculpture
mm-hmm.
and you should do this or that or nothing.
No, not preached at.
Yeah, there's no judgment in a sense. It's more discovery. Judgment and discovery are two very different.
I think people are much more receptive to being allowed to discover. I want to bring in the people that aren't going to go there on their own. You got to bait people that wouldn't go naturally. Because the nature lovers will go, I would have hiked that trail on my own. I don't need sculpture to draw me there. But the most exciting for me is to see people that wouldn't normally show up and start to build their relationship.
That is being a teacher. That's sharing your knowledge.
Mm.
You are sharing your extensive knowledge of art and land and the appreciation of the nature of art. Thank you.
Thank you.